Adela for being to chair this session, and thank you so much everyone for coming. It's really great to be able to see everyone here and see our community as well, so I'm really, really excited that you're all here. So what I'll be doing is I'll be talking about religious actors and transnational solidarity, and especially the question of Palestine. And what I'm hoping to do is to look at how religious actors in the region have responded to Gaza. It also aims to look at the different responses by these religious authorities, and perhaps to provide an understanding of why some religious actors show solidarity while others don't. So when we talk about religious actors, so I'm referring to independent preachers, I'm referring to government-sanctioned ulama, I'm looking at oppositional ulama, and often they're associated with Islamist groups. I have to be very careful when you say ulama or when you say religious actors. Some are very, very specific about what do you mean by alim, what do you mean by a religious actor, what do you mean by a preacher. So I'm just looking at all these actors, and I'm not going to go into great details in trying to define who these religious actors are and whether or not they're credible. I'll be drawing from religious actors who are largely based in Saudi Arabia, the UAE, maybe Egypt, Kuwait, as well as those who are in exile, to understand the varying responses outlined earlier. And this will be done sparingly. After all, it's only a 20-minute talk, so I have to be very careful as well. So these religious actors come from various Muslim religious traditions as well, not necessarily from one religious tradition. Some are more respected than others in terms of their religious credentials. Some are more popular than others for their media work, but they are not considered as very authoritative by their peers. It would be simplistic as well to argue that the ulama or these religious actors are all the same. So even the group of clerics who can be classified as supportive of the state can't be seen as a monolith. Some are propagandists and act as mouthpieces for the state. So while other loyalists are more quiet and will only issue religious rulings in support of the state when needed, and also even though they're more, they're supportive of the state, often when they issue religious rulings, these rulings are grounded in theological reasoning. So it's more complex than, what we understand, when we talk about these religious actors. So following, October 7, so Wasim Yusuf, a preacher, delivered a monologue against Hamas and praised Israel. So Wasim Yusuf was a Jordanian-born preacher who received Emirati citizenship and is known for his avid support for Mohammed bin Zayed, who's now the president, and the Emir of Abu Dhabi. He was the Imam, Wasim Yusuf was also the Imam of Sheikh Zayed's mosque, but was later removed. So he called for Gaza to be rid of Hamas. So this is October 7th. And he said, clearly Israel was spared of any criticisms. In fact, he was scathing of Iran and Hezbollah, and he argues that they had destroyed Iraq and Syria. We have to understand context, I suppose. The UAE normalized relations with Israel in August 2020. Soon after the deal was signed, Wasim Yusuf retweeted a video of Palestinians protesting against normalization, branding them as filthy and undeserving of Jerusalem. You can see that tweet. Yusuf was criticized for the tweet. So he doubled down on his tweet a day later, after he was, hammered on Twitter, saying that he was only defending the UAE. Interestingly, Wasim Yusuf had been critical of Israel before normalization occurred. So you can see there's a massive shift in terms of how he approached the issue of normalization. He had spoken of Palestinian rights to their homeland. He spoke out against Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands. He spoke about the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the religious obligation to preserve it. He even legitimized jihad in the name of protecting Al-Aqsa and Palestinian rights. So according to him, Palestine is the field of jihad and combat. I'm quoting him here. It is a field against the assaults of the Zionists. We'll try and understand why, perhaps later. So in August 2020, Abdurrahman As-Sudais, the Imam of the Grand Mosque of Mecca, delivered a sermon calling for everyone to converse well with Jews and treat them with respect. So he is well known for his close relations with Muhammad ibn Salman, the crown prince, and many would classify him as a propagandist, which means that he will praise the state, he will praise Muhammad ibn Salman. But he had earlier focused on the occupation and the treatment of the Palestinians at the hands of Israel. He had also made some anti-Semitic remarks. Analysts perhaps saw the 2020 sermon as an indication of religious approval for normalization. So the sermon just came weeks before Israel normalized with the UAE. So following the attacks on Gaza by Israel, the Saudi ulama who were based in Saudi Arabia were either silent, including the Grand Mufti of Saudi Arabia, Abdulaziz al-Sheikh, or were critical of Hamas. So even when Gaza's death toll increased exponentially, I mean, the Mufti of Saudi Arabia did not utter a word of condemnation or even support for Palestine. He issued a statement just after October 7, stating, you know, and I'm quoting him here, Allah has bestowed upon this country the blessing of security, stability, unity, harmony, and collective agreement. And I suppose, you know, one would assume that he's actually referring to Saudi Arabia. So in November 2023, the Grand Mufti then called for donations to be made to support the people of Gaza. So that was, you know, late 2023. And he made it very clear that the call was made at the behest of the ruler. He has since been silent again, except during Ramadan earlier this year. But what's interesting, there are also other ulama or other preachers, including Sa'id ibn Hilal, who was more vocal following October 7. So he condemned Hamas and made the statement that the group was on the wrong path. So these clerics, what's also interesting is that they have said very little, if anything, about the plight and the suffering of the Palestinians, especially in Gaza. Occasionally, statements are made to demonstrate sympathy for Gazans while blaming Hamas for their predicament. So this reflects Saudi Arabia's position as it shifts from silence to condemnation to cautious statements in dealing with the situation in Gaza, perhaps largely to manage public anger against Israel. What's interesting about these ulama or preachers as well, they discuss BDS. So loyalist clerics who are very supportive of the state and very fond of the state condemn those calling for boycotts. So they argue that individuals have no authority to call for boycotts. Who are you to call for boycotts? Only the ruler has the authority to do so. Abtawil, for example, al-Alim, who is again known for his support for rulers in general and preaches obedience to the rulers, mocked activists for their boycott campaign outside the purview of the state. Clearly, the boycott campaign is not supported by the Saudi state. In fact, in November 2023, Turki al-Sheikh, of course, if you follow Saudi Arabia's inner Saudi politics, a Saudi advisor, I mean, he's responsible for all the amazing concerts taking place in Saudi Arabia. He announced that McDonald's was a strategic partner of the Riyadh season, Mawsim Riyadh, and he promoted their buy one, get one on his social media account. So, again, there's a clear shift in the rhetoric of these ulama and preachers in countries like Saudi Arabia, like Bahrain, like the UAE when it comes to Palestine. What happened? The shift in rhetoric can be explained by looking at the nature of state clerical institutions in these countries. So their support for the state is one explanation, as these countries have normalized relations or in the process of normalizing relations with Israel. Second, regime crackdown on dissent and oppositional voices, and elevation, as well as elevation of loyalist interpretations of state clerical relations. So following the Arab uprisings, the UAE has embarked on curbing religious opposition. Only loyalist clerics were promoted. Others have faced imprisonment and are operating in exile. The Emirati government, for example, pursues its agenda by employing clerics whose ideology is one of support for the state in the name of moderate Islam and stability. So there isn't a theological grounding to their interpretations on loyalty to the state. In the case of the UAE, the loyalists include Wasim Yusuf and Abdullah bin Bayyah. So Abdullah bin Bayam, a Mauritanian-born cleric, is the head of the UAE Fatwa Council. He issued a statement endorsing the UAE's normalization with Israel in 2020. And I remember, sorry, Dan, you know, Daniel Miller, I'm gonna mention you here because we've had a long discussion about Abdullah bin Bayam. And at some point you made this, you know, this argument, and I thought it was really interesting because the idea is that bin Bayam changed his views. It's not that he changed his views on loyalty to the state, but it was the state that incorporated him into its structures due to his interpretations of state clerical relations. So I think that was really, you know, I thought it was absolutely fascinating. You see, I'm trying not to plagiarize my students. You know, wonderful arguments that
I did
make. Because I'm like, I've got to mention that. So it must be noted that bin Bayam supports the Emirati government, but I don't think it is actually fair to describe him as, you know, as a propagandist, like as today is always in use of. So it's not, you know, he wouldn't go out and go all out, but he was actually quite careful as well. So this is something that I thought was really interesting in particularly when we're trying to understand why Saudi ulama, why, you know, preachers or Emirati preachers kind of have changed the way they look at, you know, Palestine or solidarity with Palestine. I would say that perhaps post-globalism and trying to understand the limits of transnational Islam, scholars largely locate this development to the period of the 2010s. So they argue that a rise in populist and nationalist movements has led to greater skepticism of global institutions and trade agreements. So states assert their own independence and national identity. So it must also be noted that although scholars of Islam have continually questioned the concept of the nation state and its impositions by Western colonial powers, the state as a defining feature of Muslim societies has become an unacceptable norm.
Yes.
National identity is not necessarily viewed as an unacceptable concept. It is often used to enhance a sense of distinctiveness, even in religious terms. And in response to post-globalism, many states in the MENA region have embraced a post-globalization fervor that enhances national identity and promotes retention of national traditions, while maintaining their role as well as engagement with a globalized world. So countries like Saudi Arabia, the UAE, then promote their national interests in reaction to an increasingly multipolar world as well. So scholars have been writing about the rise of populist nationalism in the MENA region, including in Turkey and Saudi Arabia. Often it is done in the name of, you know, preserving state security, economic prosperity, international standing in the face of, you know, detractors and challenges. So it must be noted, as I've said, that populist rhetoric and nationalism are not new. But scholars argue that post-globalism has allowed populism to re-manifest itself in different forms. So post-globalism has, I would argue, contributed to a gradual process of de-emphasizing transnational Islamic solidarity. Mm-hmm. The post-globalization manifestation of increased nationalism propagated by the state has forced, willingly or unwillingly, the ulama to absorb nationalist language. So the language used by the state to describe detractors and to talk about reform and progress permeates the justification used by the ulama to support their rulers. I'll give you an example, the isolation of Qatar. So that was rationalized in support of the state. The ulama or these preachers or the preachers of these countries, especially state-sanctioned preachers, jumped on board to in their denunciation of Qatar. And one example was the Saudi alim Muhammad al-Arifi. So he was very vocal in his support of the blockade of So is that?
The Brad Pitt.
I use this all the time. So for those who will be doing an option with me, you'll be seeing this again. Apparently he was so good looking that women would call into his television program.
I'm lost. I don't follow Ray.
He was. His eyes.
All right.
Yeah, so maybe charisma or something.
Maybe.
Can we move on?
prayers for the protection of the Saudi state, in his words, our nation. He also urged Qatar not to interfere in the domestic affairs of Saudi Arabia. And this is despite that the fact that Al-Arifi was known for his frequent visits to Qatar before. He was also sympathetic to the Muslim Brotherhood before the removal of Morsi, Mohammed Morsi in Egypt in 2013. And there's also another prominent cleric that I've mentioned here, Aed Al-Qarni, in a revealing tweet that clearly demonstrates national identity retention. He stated, our religion, our nation, our leadership, and our citizens are red lines. They cannot be bargained or compromised. Illa Saudiya. So that was the hashtag. So again, another point that I wanted to make is the Syrian conflict also facilitated the process or enhanced the process of post-global. So the transnational Islamic solidarity exhibited by Sunni-led countries and populations during the initial stages of the Syrian civil war actually contributed to realization of the power of transnational solidarity, the realization of the power of transnational Islam. Foreign fighters from Sunni majority countries became difficult to contain, and it went wrong very quickly as the conflict became a destination for groups like Jabhat al-Nusra, Ahrar al-Sham, and ISIS to assert their brand of struggle. And the ulama of various, or preachers of various political persuasions who spoke out against the Assad regime and encouraged armed jihad, mainly for Syrians, faced intense scrutiny. So they were accused of inciting violence and inspiring citizens of their countries to participate in the conflict in Syria. But the repentant jihadis who returned from Syria cited Al-Arifi as a source of inspiration. So supporting the Palestinian struggle now could potentially be seen as problematic. So clearly for them, they're quite concerned, and the ulama themselves, or the preachers themselves, quite concerned about being accused of promoting jihad, of encouraging foreign fighters who travel to various parts of the Muslim world. The situation in Gaza highlights that some prominent religious actors in the region show limited interest. And what I can say is that, again, the killing of Yahya Sinwar, perhaps maybe I can talk about that a little bit, caused a recalibration. So some ulama who supported state narratives of anti-Islamism, normalization, and expressions of Islamism denounced Sinwar and celebrated his death. Others were silent, and they did not comment on Sinwar's death. Emiratis, some Saudi and Emirati TV personalities also celebrated Sinwar's death. On the 17th of October, the Bahraini preacher Muhammad al-Sinan, known for his anti-Hamas and anti-MB position, celebrated Sinwar's death, saying that he had brought destruction to Gaza. Other clerics, for example, Uthman al-Khamis, who's a Kuwaiti preacher, known as a propagandist as well, very supportive of the Saudi state, very supportive of, you know, state clerical relations. He argued that basically we cannot, let me just find the statement that he made. So he praised Sinwar, arguing that we might disagree with Hamas, but it was a legitimate resistance. The matter was no longer about Hamas. It was a Palestinian struggle, and Hamas was a part of the struggle. So we're not talking about Hamas anymore. We're talking about the Palestinian struggle. So the Grand Sheikh of Al-Azhar also issued a statement on the day of Sinwar's death, declaring the martyrs of the Palestinian resistance are heroes, without making any references to Yahya Sinwar. So clearly, when we're looking at the ulama in the region, in Saudi Arabia, and in other parts of the countries that I've mentioned earlier, they were very critical of Hamas, but now they're also quite concerned about public anger and how to manage public anger, because clearly some of these ulama have been very, very, have been criticized for their support or for not supporting the Palestinian concern. And finally, my final slide is that Gaza has become a source of contestation for transnational Muslim solidarity and clerical authority. I'm happy to talk about this group a little bit more. One group that has emerged is the Hayat Ulama Falestine, the Palestinian Scholars Association. It is an independent scholarly organization that brings together Islamic jurists of Palestinian origin living outside Palestine, but now it has incorporated preachers and ulama who are based elsewhere as well. And they argue that they are providing a Sharia-based perspective on Palestinian issues and their developments through systematic and scholarly methods. They're activating the role of Islamic scholars, and they're very supportive of the Palestinian cause. They're organizing conferences, and some prominent clerics have actually joined this conference as well, including the Deputy Mufti of Amman, arguing that it's time. We have to demonstrate support for the Palestinian resistance as well as support for the Palestinian cause. Thank you so much, everyone, for listening.